Imagine a monk who has been sitting on a meditation cushion, just completely still for like 30 years.
Right, a lifetime of practice.
Exactly.
Right.
Now, contrast that with a volunteer who is, you know, exactly 1 hour into a clinical psilocybin session in a hospital ward.
Two totally different worlds.
Completely. I mean, on the surface, you're looking at two people who have absolutely nothing in common. The contexts, the methods.
The whole underlying philosophy.
Yeah, the entire philosophies of what they're doing seem worlds apart. But when neuroscientists slide both of these individuals into an fMRI machine and actually look at their brains, they find something that practically defies belief.
It really is
They
one.
find the exact same quiet in the exact same place in the brain.
It's a stunning convergence, honestly. We are looking at two completely different methods arriving at the exact same neural destination.
Right.
And, for you listening right now, this isn't just abstract neuroscience. We live in an era of constant burnout, endless notifications, and just relentless mental rumination.
Oh, totally. It never stops.
It doesn't. So understanding how to quiet the brain's background noise, that constant exhausting inner monologue, is arguably the ultimate key to mental flexibility. Whether you are leading a boardroom, managing a household, or just trying to get to sleep at night, learning how this quiet happens changes everything.
Welcome to today's Deep Dive. Our mission today is to unpack a truly fascinating article from the OOTW Journal titled Psychedelics and Meditation: Two Paths Up the Same Mountain.
A great title, by the way.
It is, yeah. We are going to explore how two entirely different roads, one chemical and very sudden, the other trained and incredibly slow, somehow arrive at the exact same summit, which is the dissolving of the ordinary self. And we've got a stack of incredible sources today, ranging from cutting-edge neuroscience studies and philosophical reviews, all the way back to some legendary historical experiments from the 1960s.
Which are so fun to revisit.
Oh, absolutely. And by the way, I have to say, I'm loving your virtual backdrop today.
Yeah.
Misty Mountain landscape with the overlapping star charts, it perfectly fits the theme.
Huh. Thank you. I thought it felt appropriate for the vibe today.
Spot on. Okay, let's unpack this. We need to start with where these two trails actually meet. The physical location in your brain where both the monk and the volunteer find that silence.
Right, and that centers around the default mode network.
The DMN, right. For anyone who follows neuroscience, we know the DMN is basically the neurological equivalent of our inner narrator.
Exactly.
But the article focuses heavily on two major hubs in particular: the medial prefrontal cortex, the MPFC, and the posterior cingulate cortex, the PCC.
Yeah, those two hubs are essentially the engine room of the self-referential me.
The engine room, I like that.
Yeah, the DMN hums to life whenever you are not actively focused on a task in the outside world. So to look at the mechanics, the medial prefrontal cortex is heavily involved in mental time travel.
Like projecting yourself into the future.
Exactly, projecting into the future, planning, worrying. Meanwhile, the posterior cingulate cortex integrates your autobiographical memory.
Okay, so when you're sitting in traffic and suddenly you're like ruminating over an argument you had 3 years ago.
That is the PCC serving up the memory, yes. And the MPFC is projecting how it impacts your future. Together, they generate the continuous, unbroken story of you.
Wow. And I feel like most of us just operate with that narrative running continuously. Like we can't find the volume knob.
It's just always on.
Right. I always think of the DMN as a radio station constantly playing All About Me FM in the background of your mind.
That is a perfect analogy. All About Me FM.
But in 2011, Jensen Brewer and his colleagues at Yale University demonstrated that this volume knob actually exists and, you know, can be manually controlled.
Yeah, the Brewer study is a classic.
They brought in highly experienced meditators, people who had spent thousands of hours practicing different contemplative traditions, and put them in brain scanners.
And the results were striking.
Right. Compared to novices, these master meditators showed significant deactivation in those exact hubs, the MPFC and the PCC. They were voluntarily suppressing the physical machinery of mind wandering.
And furthermore, they showed stronger connectivity between the DMN and the brain's cognitive control regions.
Oh, so they weren't just suppressing it.
No, they were actively monitoring it. The moment the brain tried to spin up a narrative about the self, these control regions caught it and gently redirected attention back to the present moment.
That's incredible.
They were intensely present, without the heavy burden of the self narrating the experience.
Here's where it gets really interesting. Right around the same time, working in a completely different field, researchers were looking at psychedelics.
Yes. The Imperial College London study.
Exactly. In 2012, Robin Carhart-Harris and a team at Imperial College scan volunteers who were given intravenous psilocybin. Now, the prevailing assumption in psychiatry at the time was that psychedelics would, like, light the brain up, right?
Right, essentially adding a layer of hallucinatory noise over normal brain function.
Yeah.
They fully expected massive spikes in blood flow and activity.
But the fMRI scans showed the exact opposite.
It completely flipped the script.
Using arterial spin labeling to measure blood flow, they found that psilocybin drastically decreased activity and connectivity in those very same hubs, the MPFC and the PCC.
Which is mind-blowing. The drug did not add a hallucination. It subtracted a filter.
Yes. And crucially, the researchers found that the size of the drop in blood flow tracked perfectly with the intensity of the person's subjective trip.
Exactly. The deeper the physiological quiet in the DMN, the more profound the psychological ego dissolution. The ordinary boundary between self and other just collapsed.
So on one side, you have thousands of hours of intense metacognitive discipline, and on the other, a single dose of a serotonin agonist.
And both act as a dimmer switch for the exact same network.
Which begs a massive mechanical question. If meditation and psilocybin are both tools to downregulate the DMN, what happens when you apply both tools to the same brain at exactly the same time?
And that question led to some of the most compelling data in modern psychology.
Right, the Zurich trial.
Yeah, the article highlights this elegant trial from Zurich in 2019, led by Lukas Migelski and Franz Vollenweider.
What a study.
Truly. They took 38 experienced meditators on a 5-day mindfulness retreat. So this provided a highly supportive, contemplative environment. Then on day 4 of the retreat, they gave the participants a single dose of psilocybin.
And what happened?
The participants reported immense self-transcendence. They described a state of oceanic boundlessness, which is essentially a complete dissolving of the boundaries between themselves and the world around them.
Looking at the neurological data from that day, the drug fundamentally decoupled the front and the back of the default mode network.
Yes, the MPSC and the PCC were essentially taken offline from each other,
making it impossible for the brain to construct a linear timeline of the self. But wait, I want to push back on the psychological reality of this.
Sure.
Because dissolving the predictive processing models of the brain usually triggers a massive amygdala threat response. I mean, if you strip away the brain's ability to locate itself in time and space, the natural human reflex is sheer panic.
Right, fight or flight.
Exactly. Doesn't mixing an intense, boundary-dissolving drug with a silent retreat sound like a recipe for a massive panic attack?
What's fascinating here is that under normal circumstances, yes, it would. The resistance to ego dissolution is exactly what causes a challenging or traumatic psychedelic experience.
Because the brain thinks it's dying.
Precisely. The brain perceives the loss of the self as literal death. But the anxiety levels were unusually low during this Zurich study.
Really? Why?
The meditation and the context of the retreat provided a psychological and mechanical container.
Okay, break down the mechanics of that container. How does mindfulness actually buffer a chemical threat response?
Well, mindfulness training physically strengthens regions like the insula, which is responsible for interoception, your awareness of internal bodily states.
Ah, so you're more aware of what's happening inside.
Exactly. It trains the brain to observe intense sensations without immediately attaching a threat narrative to them. So when the ego started to dissolve under the psilocybin, these participants didn't engage their amygdala.
They didn't panic.
Right. Their training gave them the neurological scaffolding to simply observe the dissolution without judgment, to let go and surrender to the experience safely.
And because they didn't panic, the experience was able to take root in a durable way. The degree of ego dissolution they felt on day 4 directly predicted positive changes in their psychosocial functioning 4 months later.
Yeah, the retreat environment seemed to make the profound realizations of the trip stick.
And we see that same durability in a 2018 trial run by Roland Griffith's group at Johns Hopkins, right?
Yes, the Hopkins study is another pillar here. They gave healthy volunteers high-dose psilocybin, but paired it with varying levels of spiritual and meditative practice support over a long period.
And the results were wild.
When they followed up 6 months later, the individuals who received the high dose alongside the high level of support showed massive enduring gains. We're talking about elevated gratitude, a deeper sense of life meaning, more forgiveness, and greater interpersonal closeness.
And the strongest predictor of who kept those lasting benefits wasn't just how intense their psychedelic experience was on the day they took the drug.
No, not at all.
The strongest predictor was how much the person engaged in ongoing meditative practice afterward.
The chemical acts as a catalyst, sure. But the behavioral practice is what solidifies the structural changes in the brain.
But this raises a fundamental mechanical problem. We know what happens. The DMN quiets down. But how does it happen? I mean, a molecule of psilocybin and a 30-year meditation practice are operating on completely different physical engines.
They're entirely different engines. On a pharmacological level, classic psychedelics like psilocybin work as agonists at a very specific receptor in the brain, the serotonin 5-HT2A receptor.
The 5-HT2A, right.
Yeah. These receptors are densely clustered in the cortex, especially on layer 5 pyramidal neurons. When the psilocybin molecule physically binds to these receptors, it causes these deep layer neurons to fire asynchronously.
It's just chaos, basically.
Well, it floods the system with glutamate, which essentially scrambles the brain's usual strict top-down routing of information. The DMN loses its ability to synchronize and dictate the brain's overall rhythm.
I want to try an analogy here to make this higher entropy state relatable. Let's imagine the default mode network as like a very strict traffic cop standing in the middle of your brain.
Okay, I like this.
For your entire adult life, this cop forces every single thought, memory, and sensory input onto one main, heavily congested highway, the highway of me.
Right, the ego.
Exactly. What the psychedelic does is temporarily remove the traffic cop. Suddenly, all those cars, your thoughts and perceptions, can take dirt roads, side streets, and scenic routes they haven't used since childhood.
That's a great way to put it.
The system becomes highly fluid and disorganized, which is what Robin Carhart-Harris proposed in his 2014 Entropic Brain Hypothesis.
The traffic cop analogy illustrates the concept of entropy perfectly. In neuroscience, entropy refers to the number of possible states a system can be in.
So more entropy means more possibilities.
Exactly. The DMN normally maintains a low entropy, state rigid, highly organized, predictable. The psychedelic introduces a higher entropy state by relaxing that top-down constraint.
So brain regions that normally never speak to each other suddenly start communicating across those side streets.
Precisely. Now, contrast that sudden removal of the traffic cop with how meditation achieves a similar state.
Right, because meditation doesn't use a chemical to remove the cop.
No. It operates on neuroplasticity and Hebbian learning, the principle that neurons that fire together wire together, and conversely, those that fall out of sync lose their link.
It sounds like one route is a skeleton key that suddenly picks the lock, while the other is a path worn smooth by 10,000 footsteps. They open the same door, but the effort is totally different.
That's it, exactly. With meditation, you are slowly, deliberately dismantling the physical infrastructure of that main highway over decades.
Wow.
Through repeated attentional and metacognitive training, you are structurally weakening the synapses of the default mode network. You are training your salience network to catch the DMN before it spirals, gently pulling attention back to the present moment over and over again.
Just chipping away at it.
Yes. Advanced meditation eventually reaches a very similar state of lucid self-modeling, but it does it by carefully tuning the system from the inside rather than flooding it with a pharmacological disruptor.
And because the underlying effort and mechanisms are so completely different, we have to address a major philosophical crossroads here.
This is crucial.
We've established both methods can reach the same summit, but are these states actually identical? The article heavily explores a 2018 review by Raphael Millière and his colleagues, warning against conflating the two.
Yeah, we risk confusing a tourist who helicopters to the top of a mountain for an afternoon with a mountaineer who has spent a lifetime mapping the terrain.
Exactly. Millière's review emphasizes that they share phenomenal overlaps, namely the loss of the sense of self. But they differ radically in controllability and content.
Right. A drug induces a temporary low ego state, but it arrives unbidden, takes you on a ride you can't easily steer, and fades away as the drug metabolizes.
And it often involves intense visual and sensory flooding.
Yes. Very loud, phenomenologically speaking. Conversely, deep meditative states, like the jhanas in Buddhism, are often characterized by a profound withdrawal from sensory input.
A master meditator builds a durable, voluntary capacity to quiet the self on demand amidst the chaos of daily life. You get the view, but you also build the physical and psychological muscles to stay there.
Which aligns with the honest cautions many contemplative traditions hold regarding intoxicants. If you haven't earned the insight through rigorous neuroplastic rewiring, the sudden dismantling of your ego can be deeply destabilizing.
Yeah, that makes sense. Outside of carefully controlled clinical settings, psychedelics carry substantial psychological risks.
They really do. If you strip away the ego's predictive models without a proper container, it can leave a person ungrounded, confused, or even traumatized.
Whereas the meditative path builds the necessary psychological resilience first, ensuring that when the boundaries of the self dissolve, the mind remains stable. So what does this all mean? Are we saying psychedelics are basically just a spiritual cheat code, or is there a legitimate division of labor here?
Well, as the research suggests, meditation provides the safe container for the psychedelic experience to be processed, while the psychedelic provides the meditative path with a vivid, undeniable preview of where the practice actually leads.
Preview.
Yes. Many people meditate for years and hit a plateau, wondering if the loss of self is even possible. The chemical glimpse proves the destination exists.
But we must also look at how permanent that glimpse can be. I mean, can an afternoon of pharmacological intervention leave a durable trace on a person's underlying psychology?
It's a great question. And a 2011 study by Catherine McLean addressed exactly this by looking at adult personality traits, which are historically considered to be incredibly rigid.
Right. By the time an individual reaches their 30s, core traits are essentially set in stone.
Usually, yes. But McLean's data showed that a single high dose of psilocybin durably raised the personality trait of openness for over a year.
Hold on. Personality traits like openness are supposed to be rock solid in adults. You're telling me an afternoon in a clinic can permanently alter the scaffolding of an adult's personality?
I am. To contextualize that, openness is one of the big five personality traits, governing a person's willingness to embrace new ideas, aesthetic experiences, and alternative ways of thinking.
And it typically decreases as we age.
It does. So the fact that a single clinical session can permanently reverse that decline and alter the scaffolding of an adult's personality is profound. But there is a massive caveat in the data.
What's the caveat?
The permanent shift in openness only occurred in the participants who achieved a complete mystical experience during their session.
Oh, wow. So it wasn't just taking the drug.
Exactly. If the dose simply provided a mild emotional release or visual changes, their baseline personality did not shift. The pharmacological intervention had to occasion a profound, undeniable sense of unity, sacredness, and transcendence of time and space to trigger long-term psychological change.
Now, some might hear this and assume we are just looking at a 21st century biohacking placebo effect. Like, people in modern clinics expect to have a mystical experience, so they do.
Sure, cultural priming is real.
But the article points back to one of the most famous experiments in psychedelic history to prove this phenomenon transcends modern cultural priming. Let's look at the Good Friday experiment of 1962.
Yes. Conducted by a physician named Walter Ponke, this was a double-blind study held in the basement chapel of Boston University during a Good Friday service.
Such a fascinating setup.
It was. Ponke gathered 20 divinity students, individuals already dedicating their lives to a spiritual framework. Half received an active placebo, specifically niacin, which causes a physical flesh to confuse expectations. Very. And the other half received psilocybin.
And the students who received the psilocybin reported profound mystical experiences that perfectly mirrored the writings of the great religious mystics throughout history.
They did. But the true weight of the study didn't become apparent until decades later, when researcher Rick Doblin conducted a long-term follow-up.
Doblin tracked these individuals down 25 years after that afternoon in the chapel basement.
And what he found is staggering. The majority of those who took the psilocybin still ranked it among the most spiritually significant events of their entire lives.
25 years later.
A quarter of a century later, yes.
Yeah.
The experience had not faded into a mere memory of a drug trip. It remained a foundational pillar of their worldview.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, when the glimpse is deep enough, when the serotonin receptors cascade in just the right way to completely quiet the default mode network, it leaves an individual permanently more open to the path of continued growth.
Absolutely. It fundamentally opens the door.
Synthesizing all of this, the division of labor between the two paths crystallizes into a beautiful piece of imagery from the text.
Flare analogy.
Yes, the flare. The psychedelic is a flare. It shoots up into the night sky and lights up the entire valley all at once. For a few hours, you can see every peak, every river, every hidden path. It shows you that the solid, rigid self you thought you were is actually entirely negotiable.
But the flare always burns out.
Right. And meditation is the slow art of learning to walk that terrain in the daylight, completely sober, putting one foot in front of the other again and again.
One shows you the mountain, the other trains you to climb it.
Beautifully said.
And, you know, this matters deeply, even if you never step foot in a clinical trial or sit on a meditation cushion. Just having the knowledge that the rigid, chattering narrator inside your head, the one that causes so much daily anxiety, rumination, and burnout, is merely a brain network.
It's just hardware.
Exactly. It is not the ultimate truth of who you are. It is just a highly active neural circuit that can be turned down.
That realization alone takes an immense amount of pressure off the daily human experience. You are not trapped in the narrative of the default mode network. The brain is flexible and the self is fluid.
This raises an important question, one that I want to leave you with today.
Let's hear it.
If the self that you experience every single day with all its anxieties, preferences, and rigid historical stories is just a specific configuration of a brain network. Well, a network that could be turned down like a dimmer switch.
Yeah.
What does that mean for who you actually are when the background noise finally stops?
Wow, that is a question worth sitting with. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive. We hope this exploration helps you keep questioning the mechanics of your own mind. Because whether you are a monk who's been on a cushion for 30 years or a volunteer just beginning to explore the depths of consciousness, the summit of the mountain remains exactly the same. We'll catch you next time.